This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're going to be talking tonight an update on immigration and the effect of recent immigration rulings on people and proceedings. My guests are Elise Shugal, a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. She's directing attorney, the Immigration Program Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto, which, for those of you who don't know, is a city in San Mateo County, California. Miriam Kelly, senior attorney and supervisor of the DACA-DAPA program of Community Legal Services. Thomas Ruge, board certified in civil trial advocacy by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. He's a partner in the Indianapolis, Indiana law office of Lewis Capps. And not last but certainly not least is J. Antonio Nieres, a certified specialist in immigration and nationality law, a member of the board of directors of the National Board of Trial Advocacy. His law office is in Burlingame. This segment for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and also by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Additional funding for the program is provided by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. I welcome the four of you to the program and all of you who are listening. We are going to start with an update of the current situation by turning to Miriam Kelly with regard to the DACA and DAPA programs. Would you do this, though, Miriam, for those who are not familiar with what DACA and DAPA stand for? Start with that and tell us what those letters stand for.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having us. And, you know, immigration, we really love our acronyms of everything. We kind of forget that these are not actual words, they're acronyms. So just to back it up a little bit, DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So that's a program that's been around actually since 2012, which helps, you know, children who were brought to the, well, people who were brought to the U.S. as children, so they could access protection from deportation and, work authorization. That program's been around since 2012. That program continues. The newer programs that were announced back in November of 2014 were an expansion of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, which would make larger the class of people who'd be eligible for this benefit. So there's a time cutoff. It made the time cutoff a little bit later. It took away an age cap, so it brought a lot more people into eligibility. The bigger program that was announced was DAPA, so that's Deferred Action for Parents of Americans.
D-A-P-A.
So, D-A-P-A, okay. DAPA, yes. So the DAPA program was actually really exciting. So the Obama administration announced this in November of 2014 that alongside the expansion of DACA, which was already in effect, the DAPA program would grant deferred action status to people who have been in the U.S. since at least 2010 until present day, and if they had a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident child. So that actually could have extended to 5+ million people and would have been by far the biggest development in my career and all of our careers as far as like helping people who are undocumented to, you know, not having full legal status or a route to permanent resident status or citizenship, but to have protection from deportation and having work authorization. So we were really excited. We were kind of ready to go after this announcement. I remember, you know, just before maybe February of 2015, we had workshops to be ready to go to assist people in applying for these benefits free of charge. And that's when Texas and 25 other states got together to sue the federal government to block the administration's initiatives, essentially saying that President Obama was acting way outside of his authority and he could not do something like this. So an injunction was filed in the Southern District of Texas, and it was granted. So as of February 2015, the programs were granted and they hadn't gotten into effect. So I think Tom later on is going to break us up through the, you know, procedural history of the case. But, you know, after going through to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and then going up to the Supreme Court, we got a decision on June 23rd of this year from the Supreme Court. And I say decision kind of like in a loose sense. It wasn't a decision. It was a non-decision. It
yes.
was one line from the court.
4-4.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Just saying that this the lower court's decision was upheld by an equally divided court. And that was it. So we were waiting and waiting for something from the Supreme Court. But eventually, you know, unfortunately, the different chain of events that led to having a court that could split 4-4 led to the not having any actual decision on this matter. So the lower court's decision stood, and that means that 5+ million people couldn't avail themselves of DACA, the expansion of DACA, or DAPA. So it's important to note that, like, DACA, the program that I first talked about that's been around since 2012, has been unaffected. Whoever was eligible for that mm-hmm. continue to be eligible for it. But the big programs that would have expanded that class, as well as, you know, to the parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, unfortunately, that's out of reach.
Tom Ruggie, what comments do you have with respect to U.S. v. Texas and essentially the non-decision of our U.S. Supreme Court?
Right. Well, I think Miriam did an excellent job of summarizing DACA and DAPA. One additional comment I would make that becomes important when we get into the procedural steps the Texas case has gone through is that none of these programs create what's called substantive rights or a path to citizenship. It is a deferral of a removal. They're not going to be removed.
Deferral of removal from the United States. Is that what you're saying?
Pardon me?
It is a deferral of removal from the United States.
Right. They have to step forward. And another thing I always remind people, clients in particular, that you have to prove that you qualify for these things. You have to demonstrate with usually with documentation that you've been here the length of time, that you were at the right age, and that. So it's not something that's automatic, but it isn't exactly a substantive right either. So what happened was within hours, actually, of the announcement of this new program, this expansion of DACA and the institution of what we are calling DAPA, there were two lawsuits filed, one in Washington by our well-known Arizona sheriff, Mr. Arpaio. That ultimately was dismissed, and the appeal on that was also dismissed. So that ended up not going well for the sheriff. However, in Texas, in the Southern District, they did file for a preliminary injunction that was granted by what we call the trial court, the U.S. District Court, stopping this expansion, not stopping DAPA. And the Department of Justice appealed that order to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So from a district court, the trial court level, there is a court of appeals that's next step, and then a divided panel on November 9th, 2015, essentially upheld the lower court's decision, a 2-1 decision. The Justice Department did seek review with the Supreme Court certiorari, which was actually granted initially, and then ultimately, I think it was on June 23rd, the Supreme Court entered a 9-word decision saying it's 4-4 split. And therefore, the effect of that is that the ruling of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is upheld, which upheld the district court ruling, which, as Marion described, really puts the kibosh on the whole program. So it's important, though, I want to talk a little bit about the basis for the decision. The first question that had to be addressed was whether Texas has standing to even bring the lawsuit. Under what conditions does a state, in this case a state or other entity or person, have a substantial enough interest in the program to have standing? And that's actually a close and somewhat arcane and pages of this 120-page, 130-page decision go off on standing. Ultimately, the call is that they do, and the basis for that is that it would make a lot of people eligible for driver's licenses in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a stretch, but we're not getting into the policy just yet. The second legal point is that this federal government should have gone through what's called a rulemaking process, where they publish their intention to do something in the way of implementing a statute, and there's a time for comment, and then it's eventually adopted. The Obama administration did not do that, and saying it was really all this relates to is our discretionary decisions by the agency, and therefore we don't have to do rulemaking, but the courts disagreed with them. The third legal point is that the Court of Appeals found the action to be arbitrary and capricious, which mostly circles back to the fact that they didn't go through the normal rulemaking procedure. And finally, the trial court had made an argument under a clause in the Constitution called the Take Care Clause, which the executive branch, the president and his and all the agencies are supposed to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And that was not adopted by the Court of Appeals. And that's a good idea, I think, to, it would give sort of a carte blanche opportunity for a state to challenge anything it didn't like about the what the how the federal government was handling.
Well, let me ask you this, if I may, to the four of you. As I understand it from certainly what Miriam mentioned, that this involved, this case that now is referred to as U.S. v. Texas, and the whole proceeding that ended up with a nine-word decision of the members of the Supreme Court, 4-4, there were 4 to 5 million people who might have benefited from this. What happens to them now? Tony, do you have any comments on this, or should we come back to Miriam on this?
No,
Come closer to the mic.
I think that because it's a 4-4 decision, it's the status quo remains. It just nothing happens.
So, in other words, these 4 to 5 million people who may not be documented, they're not documented here. Is that correct?
Yes.
That does that mean that they will not be transported out of the country?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that, but it does mean that they're left to the same status as they were before.
Which is undocumented.
Correct, yeah.
Elise, what comments do you have about this with regard to the 4 to 5 million people? Anything else?
It was extremely disappointing for that population and for the entire immigrants' rights community. President Obama's announcement in November of 2014 was a huge step, and it was something that he decided to do because Congress just simply hasn't acted. He's tried to move comprehensive immigration reform forward. There was some movement in Congress a couple of years ago, but everything stalled. And so this was at least something that this large population of people were hoping to count on,
mm-hmm.
to be able to come out of the shadows, to be able to work legally, to have a Social Security number. Those were things that this community was really, really excited about. So the decision was a huge disappointment for, you know, a large population of undocumented immigrants as well as the immigrants' rights community.
Just to clarify something, I think we've all heard that the number in the United States is somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 million undocumented persons. The other, whether it's 7 or 8 million people who were not affected by the U.S. v. Texas case, I take it there's no relevancy here to the U.S. v. Texas case as far as these other people. Is that right?
Well, you know,
Miriam?
The whole way through, ever since we learned of the announcement in November of 2014, we've been holding a lot of community events and presentations and just making sure that people are aware of it. So even though functionally if the programs went through and it affected 5 million people, so many more people would have questions about whether they were eligible. Mm-hmm. I think a huge gap that was left off of these programs were people who do not have U.S. citizen children. That's
yes.
a huge
yes.
base of
that's,
our community that we serve.
That's about the 8 million we're talking about, right?
Sure, yeah.
Or they
came here later than yeah. the 2010 cutoff that mm-hmm. was prescribed in the memo, or, you know, for whatever other reason, they were outside of eligibility. So as we were doing all these community forums, you know, we identified a lot of people as possible eligible for it, but at the same time also people that were not going to be able to take advantage of it. And you know, as the decision from the Supreme Court came out, we had an event set up at a church which attracted a lot of people right afterward, and it was just really interesting to see the reactions of people, because we saw a lot of tears, but the tears were kind of from us, you know, the tears were from us as immigration advocates.
Yeah,
because,
yeah,
you know, it's just, it's very difficult to meet with somebody and have a consult with them, and they've been here for 20 years, and they've paid their taxes every year of the 20 years, and their kids are older now and in school and going on to their careers, and they're just hoping
and
for something.
And their kids, though, were citizens born in this country?
Yeah, a lot of times, absolutely, okay.
Who are here legally,
mm-hmm, right,
since they were born,
born
in
here.
This country.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you this. Tom, let me... Tom, go ahead.
Excuse me, Chuck, this is Tom, but on that point, I think the statistics bear out, and I wish I had them right with me, but vast majority of the folks that are undocumented have a U.S. citizen or permanent resident relative in their
mm-hmm.
family,
mm-hmm.
In most cases, immediate relative.
I see.
So I think that's important to put a little color into who these folks are.
Yeah. Tom, let me ask you this also. What prognosis do you see with respect to where we're going now in light of the U.S. v. Texas decision? Or do you have a prognosis?
Well, I think that we're it's hard to make the call, but I think we're going to bog down into lengthy litigation in that case specifically. And some people have talked about it. I don't know if that's going to happen, and nothing probably going to happen until after the election. But
mm-hmm.
one thing they might try is doing the rulemaking process and publishing a change and what they want to do, get the comments, and then go forward with it and see if that changes the complexion of the case sufficiently to make it successful on the second time around.
Who's going to do the rulemaking, though? Who's going to...
Department of...
Go ahead.
Homeland Security.
Homeland Security, okay.
Yeah,
I got
United
you.
States Citizenship and Immigration Services.
One of the things that I think we're all concerned about, and by the way, for those of you who are interested, this program, I think I told you at the beginning, is funded in partnership by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies 11 fields of law, and by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which certifies 4 fields of law. So it's a total of 15 fields. If any of you are looking for a certified specialist in any one of these 15 fields of law, I want you to jot down wherever you may be in the state of California or perhaps outside of the state of California. I'll give you the website that you might go to help you find a specialist. It's the Board of Legal Specialization State of California website, www.calbar.ca.gov, calbar.ca.gov, and go to the upper left corner of your screen on your computer to legal specialists, and that's how you can find any one of these 15 specialties through the California Board of Legal Specialization or the National Board of Trial Advocacy. One of the things that in my experience as a deputy district attorney for San Mateo County over the years, aside from being the producer and host of this radio program, is that personally I got involved with some people who were trying to get help from notarios, N-O-T-A-R-I-O-S. And my understanding that there were some problems there, and I had to bring some actions against people in San Mateo County, which, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is south of San Francisco. Of course, it's in California. And there's something called temporary protected status, and I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about the concern that perhaps some undocumented people may have in trying to get some help in terms of dealing with notarios. And this is something not just in California, but across the United States. Who would like to start on this? Do you want to, Elise? Go ahead,
sure.
If you would, please.
Sure. And I just want to say that notarios are a problem not just in respect to TPS, temporary protected status, but in all aspects of immigration law, including, for example, with the decision in U.S. v. Texas. Part of the reason that our organization arranged for community events immediately after the decision, regardless of what the decision was going to be, was because we wanted to make sure that the community was educated on what was happening with respect to DAPA and expanded DACA to ensure that they had the information they needed to empower themselves so that they wouldn't be taken advantage of by notarios in the community who are trying to
the confusion right. that I understand, and I'll be very brief on this, is that in Spanish-speaking countries such as Mexico, a notario means an attorney, as I understand it. Whereas in the United States, notario is a term used by people, but doesn't necessarily mean that those persons are licensed to practice law in any state whatsoever. Am I right, Elise,
correct.
On that? And
that's
the danger for people who are, let's say, Spanish-speaking, whether they're from Mexico or where else. They're thinking that this person is authorized to practice law.
Correct. And generally, they're not. Generally, notarios are notaries who are notaries.
Yeah.
You know, they might be able to help fill out some forms. They might be able to do some clerical work and notarize documents, but they certainly aren't licensed to practice law. And in many cases, they're within the immigrant communities. And so they are seen as trustworthy because they're part of the community. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, like you mentioned, they actually prey upon people who don't have sufficient information and go to them for help and then end up spending a lot of money and, get defrauded and oftentimes end up deported because of what the notario did.
The improper so-called legal recommendation of a notario. I mean, that was the experience I had in the cases I handled where people had spent a lot of money. Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
Well, I'm sure at least you would agree that it isn't just in the Latino community. In fact, there's some
absolutely
pretty famous
not.
Cases right there in San Francisco involving the Sikh community in India.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Agents, were helping out and, big mess.
What recommendation for those people who, let's say, are trying to get help, generally speaking, what recommendation, Tom, would you have for someone who is trying to do this in a legal way to try to find what might be the legal path to take to become documented in the United States? What thoughts do you have, Tom?
Well, there are some good resources that you can learn a lot on your own by going to websites that can start you off. Not necessarily get you through it, but it gets you a lot more educated if you're someone looking for information. The National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights is an organization that has reliable information. The American Immigration Lawyers Association, AILA, has reliable information. The American Immigrant Council, and you can Google these. And the government website, uscis.gov, has, if you take the time to read what they have and read the instructions on forms that seem to apply, get you a lot of information, sometimes telling you that you've got some documentation to put together. So you can learn a lot.
No, which website was that?
There are several.
The last one you mentioned.
Yeah, it's the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Okay.
Which is uscis.gov. The problem is all these are limited.
Yeah.
They don't have everything. They can't answer every question somebody might have, and you could have a peculiar situation like, what about that drunk driving conviction I have in Honduras from 12 years ago? Does that affect anything? And that's probably not going to be answered. And there are some subtle things that can come up. So you really need an experienced practitioner before you actually move forward on a petition.
I'm suggesting for people that they need to go to certification. I mean, obviously, that the uscis.gov and some of the others that Tom mentioned are important, but you need to certainly deal with an attorney who has the knowledge of immigration law. And I've got to say this, you don't want a personal injury attorney, you don't want a landlord-tenant attorney, you don't want an employment attorney, you want an attorney, wherever you are in the United States, you want an attorney who has experience in immigration law. Let me do this. Go ahead, Mariam.
Oh, yeah, sure. I was just saying also, like, a lot of times our client base is not super internet savvy, and I always suggest to people, you know, yes, like you can do the research on your own, but especially in the Bay Area, there are so many immigration legal services organizations, which are nonprofits that offer either free consultations or very low cost consultations. Mm-hmm. And they could have an individualized consult specific to their own set of legal mm-hmm. issues mm-hmm. and feel, you know, more reliably that they're getting proper advice. And that's also a good way of avoiding notario fraud, because you can, you know, find an organization such as our organization, Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto, in which, you know, there are immigration attorneys on board that are there that are giving the consultations and giving the information. And people just really, you know, when they're getting immigration legal advice, should really make sure that who they're speaking to is somebody who is an actual an immigration attorney or somebody who's accredited by the Board of Immigration Appeals and has, like, the right, you know, certifications and, you know, license and expertise to be able to advise them in the proper way.
When you say the Board of Immigration Appeals, mm-hmm. what level is that?
So there are a few different levels. There's the immigration court level, and then one level above that is
the
Board
federal,
of Immigration.
This is the federal level. Are
yes.
you not talking about? Okay.
Yes, exactly. So okay. the Board of Immigration Appeals has a process by which people who are not immigration attorneys can get a certain kind of accreditation to be able to give immigration legal advice, mm-hmm. and depending on their level of accreditation, to represent people before U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and then in the highest level of accreditation can actually represent them before the immigration court. So it's just really important to make sure that, you know, people in the immigrant community know that when they're speaking to somebody, is this person an immigration attorney? Are they licensed? Are they accredited by the Board of Immigration Appeals? Because if they're not, and if they're a no notary or somebody in the community who maybe has a good reputation from what they've heard, but is not actually somebody who should be giving that advice, that person is engaging in an unauthorized practice of law.
And that's
there are lots of consequences.
That's certainly what we don't want.
Exactly.
We don't want the unauthorized practice of law. Tom, we have about 30 seconds left of the statewide version, which is recorded and then sent out to 15 other stations in California. We will continue live in the San Francisco Bay Area for another half hour. We'll continue live on the internet at www.kalw.org. And of course, the entire program is uplinked to the NPR satellite. Tom, in just a few seconds, what recommendation do you have? And you only have just a very few seconds.
Recommendation for
finding somebody to help you.
Pardon me?
To find someone to help you.
Yeah, no, I think that Miriam's exactly right. There are good neighborhood organizations. In Indiana, there's a Neighborhood Christian Legal Services Program, and there's the Indiana Legal Services Program, which I practiced in for 5 years.
Probably every state has something like this. We must end a half hour, and then we're going to invite people to call in. All right, everybody, it is California time right now, 7:27 and nearly a half p.m., and I want to invite you to call in, ask questions if you have questions on immigration and nationality law. The number is toll-free, by the way, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I want to let you know, in case you've tuned in a little bit late, there's an awful lot of information, of course, in the immigration and nationality law area, much of which we haven't even touched upon on this program because we are limited by time. But let me tell you who my guests are. Elise Shugal, she's a specialist in immigration and nationality law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. She's directing attorney of the Immigration Program, Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto, California. Miriam Kelly, Senior Attorney and Supervisor of the DACA-DAPA Program of Community Legal Services. Thomas Ruge, Board Certified in Civil Trial Advocacy by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. He's a partner in the Indianapolis, Indiana Law Office of Lewis Capps. And J. Antonio Nieres, a Certified Specialist in Immigration and Nationality Law, who's a member of the Board of Directors of the National Board of Trial Advocacy. His office is in Burlingame. What I want to do right now is give you something, again, the toll-free number, and please don't be shy about this, 866-798-8255, wherever you are. If you're listening to the live program, we are doing this on Wednesday evening, August 10th, 2016. If you get this program delayed after August 10th, the phone won't work. So we're doing this live, August 10th, 2016, 866-798-8255. 798-8255. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, it also has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. In California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced, a lawyer who's experienced, to do a half an hour consultation with you. And with minor exception, for a half an hour consultation with a lawyer, you'll be charged $25 to $35. Additional funding for your legal rights is made possible by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. People are being quiet. They are not calling, and I'm not happy about that. I'd like you to feel comfortable enough to call if you have any questions or concerns about immigration or nationality law. Tom, what, or at least you want to, I can tell you would like to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to jump off on what we were talking about earlier. You asked me about temporary protected status.
Yes,
so I wanted
please.
To come back to that since we didn't have a chance to talk
would.
About it. And I just wanted to mention it because in terms of talking about notario fraud, we have started to hear some issues in the immigrant community about people hearing from notarios that in the process of applying for temporary protected status, they might also be able to apply for their children. And that's not exactly true. There's very complex issues in that, and some children may be eligible for temporary protected status, but it means they must have entered the country at a particular time.
Would you do this though for us, Elise? Because
sure.
I'm not sure. I certainly don't know. What is temporary protected status? What does that mean?
Temporary protected status is a humanitarian program that is within the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. It's a humanitarian program that it allows for temporary status mm-hmm. for people from certain countries that are designated by the U.S. government. It's generally after natural disasters or some sort of severe civil strife.
So, in other words, if I may interrupt for just mm-hmm. a moment, temporary protective status was not involved in U.S. v. Texas. Is that
correct.
Right? Okay.
It's
pardon
different.
Me. Go ahead.
Yes. So temporary protective status is actual legal status, but it's temporary. Mm-hmm. The government generally designates it for like an 18-month period, and then generally it gets extended multiple times over the course of many, many years. So, for example, El Salvador is one designated country. It was originally designated in 2001, and it's currently in a re-registration period. The re-registration period for El Salvador is between July 8th and September 6th of 2016. And so this is why I think we're starting to hear these questions, because there are people in the El Salvadoran community who are starting to look at applying to re-register, and they're hearing these different things. And I think the reason that they're hearing it is because there's also this program that was created relatively recently called the Central American Minors Program. And that also includes El Salvador, but it's a completely different program. The Central American Minors Program is a special program for refugee processing mm-hmm. for children that are in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and are children of people in the United States with lawful status.
So these children are in those countries, but their parents are here in the United States
correct.
With lawful
legally.
Status?
Correct.
I
and
see.
So it's You can certainly see how there'd be some confusion in the Central American community about how those two things may interrelate. And in some ways they do, because someone with temporary protected status in the United States who has a child in one of those three countries may be eligible to apply for refugee status for their child that's in that country.
When you say child, are you talking about a certain age level? Are we talking about young children? Are we talking about adult children or what?
I believe it's been expanded to include adult children as well. It's minor children and adult children is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that was one of the recent expansions of the program. In that program, the children are abroad and they need to remain abroad until this process is completed, whereas temporary protected status is for people who are in the United States and they must have entered by a certain time.
I see. By what time must they have entered?
It depends on the country.
Really? Oh, my.
So each country is designated.
No matter how confusing it must be. Go ahead, pardon
me. Yes, each country that's been designated has different time frames, because the time frame is connected with whatever issue, being natural disaster or civil strife, created the circumstance that allowed it to be designated.
Oh, my. Are you dealing, Tom, with any of the people on those, the last issues that Elise brought up?
Yes.
You are?
I do. I would suspect that the volume's a little higher in California than it is in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we have our TPS and, in some cases, asylum cases for Central Americans, yeah.
I see. How about you, Tony? What comments do you have in this area?
Just Central America.
Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead, Tom.
I'm sorry. Temporary protected status isn't just for people in Central America. There are other countries that have been designated.
I see. Okay. Tony, what comments do you have in this area, if any?
I guess I'll go to the general idea that you've got to get your information correctly.
Yeah.
One of the best ways is really to talk to people who are in the know, who know the distinctions between the different programs,
mm-hmm.
And who are not out to make a quick buck. Of course, it's always good to get someone certified so that there is some assurance that the person is supposed to know what he's talking about, mm-hmm. or what, at least as far as the immigration law is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tom, what other issues do you want to include in the second half hour? And by the way, let me give the phone number again. People are very quiet. And again, we're doing this program live on Wednesday evening in California. It's August 10th. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. If you have a question about immigration or nationality law, we would welcome you to join us. Please don't wait another 15 or 20 minutes, because we'll be over at that point. Tom, what thoughts do you have? Any other thoughts?
Well, one thing I wanted to bring up for people who might have been listening to the discussion about DACA and the DACA expansion and the Supreme Court decision and Fifth Circuit Court decision that have enjoined the expansion is the idea about enforcement priority. So people who may have been hopeful that they would qualify because they had U.S. citizen children now don't qualify for this program, or the program just doesn't exist for them to become certified as eligible for DAPA, get an employment card, and deferred action on any removal, is that those folks who would have qualified for DAPA, there is a screening process involved in each one of these. You can't have a serious misdemeanor, and you can't have, or serious isn't the word, and you can't have multiple misdemeanors nor a felony conviction. People who qualify and don't have those problems probably are not enforcement priorities for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks. So they can be disappointed that this didn't happen, but they're probably not going to be targeted either. That's, so I don't want to give people a false sense of security. Don't worry about it, because it is troublesome. You don't have lawful status. But on the other hand, you shouldn't be too fearful that somebody's going to be knocking on your door, because you're not a likely enforcement priority if you would have qualified for the DACA expansion or DAPA.
I've just received a question from a listener, and I'd like to read this to you and see how the four of you might respond to this. And this is the question from this listener. I'm very confused hearing the presidential candidates talking about immigration reform. Republican nominee Donald Trump says he will build a wall along the Mexican border and force Mexico to pay for it. This is the first question. Can he do that? Question mark. Then the next question is, Trump also wants to bar all Muslim immigrants, but I think he amended that. He wants to bar all immigrants from countries with ties to terrorism. Can he do that? Now, this listener would like you to respond to this, and I'm wondering if any of you have any responses. So far, nobody. Okay.
I was waiting
all right,
for
Miriam, go yeah. through it. Go do it.
Please. I was waiting for somebody to bring up Donald Trump. I'm surprised we got through 30 minutes of the show without it. Yeah. So, as far as the whole wall thing, can Donald Trump do that? No. It's impossible. If you read like actual studies on it, people have actually taken the time to study how much it would really cost to build a wall. And this wall would crosses over land masses and water that a wall can't be built on anyway. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is I think estimated costs of this wall would be like something around $40 billion. I could be wrong on the number, but it seemed like something insane like that. So it becomes hard to even envision having those kinds of funds available for the deportation of a community of 11 to 12 million undocumented people and, you know, using that money towards removing them from the United States as opposed to all the other areas that which we could definitely use all that money for.
Does anyone else have a comment with respect to whether or not Donald Trump can force Mexico to pay for this wall? Anybody else? Elise, go ahead.
I mean, there's just no way that a president of one country can force the president of a sovereign nation to do something. Like, that's just not – I don't see how that would be feasible in any way. There'd have to be some sort of international treaty or something that would allow that to happen. You know, there's a lot of international law issues involved, and I don't see any way that – the Mexican government would ever actually agree to do that, given the United States doesn't have the dollars to pay for it. There's no way Mexico
Donald Trump
does
said he
either.
Would have Mexico pay
well,
for
right,
it.
But
yeah.
What I'm saying, the United States has a lot more money than Mexico
sure.
does, and the United States wouldn't be able to afford to do it. So there's no way Mexico would either.
How about the second question? Was
could I,
yeah, go ahead, Tom, please.
Excuse
yeah.
me for interrupting.
Sure,
but
no, please.
I think you have to also look at can he legally deserve. There a legal basis for him to move forward with that kind of a plan? And I just wonder if, you know, Texas, the state of Texas, would sue him if he tried it because of going too far without going through either rulemaking or a legislative change. I think he would need to get a law passed rather than just do it as a matter of executive action. So I think.
Well, I hope someone sends
challenge.
Him that message. How about the second question? And that is. Donald Trump wants to bar all Muslim immigrants, but this listener says, but I think he amended that. He wants to bar all immigrants from countries with ties to terrorism, and can he do this? Who wants to start with that? Miriam, you want to start with that? What do you say?
I mean, Elise, why don't you take? Because there's like I don't even know where to begin on how to answer that question
right.
because it's so insane.
Okay, Elise.
I mean, there's certainly. Statutory issues that are raised. There's constitutional issues that are raised in that question. The immigration statute provides for certain types of visas for certain types of people who qualify for those visas. And there are places within the immigration law where there's differentiation between countries. For example, we all hear the candidates, for example, when talking about immigration reform, talking about waiting in line, right? And no one actually knows what that means. What the line is people who are waiting for visa numbers to become current. And that's differentiated between countries because there's essentially a quota system. And so some countries are what we call oversubscribed, and so people are waiting in line.
And we're
that's what that's about.
We're talking waiting years.
Correct.
Are we not?
Correct.
No matter what country we're talking about.
Right. Okay. So I raise that because that's one place in the law where there is differentiation among countries. Mm-hmm. That being said, it's not a situation where some countries, you know, are allowed to have people immigrate and others aren't. TPS, which we recently talked about, is another place in the law where there's a differentiation between countries because some countries are experiencing humanitarian crises and they may get benefits under U.S. immigration law. But there's really no precedent within this statute to bar people from certain countries from entering. Mm-hmm. There have been circumstances where people from certain countries, like when we've heard like in the Bush administration talk about countries that are state-sponsored terrorism. Mm-hmm. People from those countries sometimes have to go through extra screenings. Shortly after September 11th, there was a process called special registration where certain men from certain countries that were, you know, state-sponsored terrorism countries had to go through this special registration process. That was through an amendment to the Federal Register. So there are circumstances where there are special rules or special laws as they relate to people from certain countries, but I don't know of any situation where an entire population of people was barred from even applying to enter the United States.
Well, are you all ready for us to take our first caller? All right, let's do this then. Chris, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Chris, are you there?
I'm here, thank you.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Great, thanks. I have two questions if we have time, which is about taxation and incarceration related to illegal immigrants, and hoping our guests can shed some light on this because there is a lot of rhetoric in the election cycle. But in terms of taxation, I'm just wondering, some people have mentioned the payment of taxes. How does that actually work for someone who's undocumented or an illegal immigrant? Do we have any idea what percentage of folks are actually paying taxes, or what that contribution is?
Let me do this. Ask your second question, and then I'll ask you to go back on your radio. What's the second question, Chris?
Great. So in terms of incarceration, heard some of the coverage of local jails and of folks who are kind of barely squeaking by, or also in potentially legally compromised situations who might get picked up on some minor charge but can't get out on bail and then end up basically having their lives ruined in the process.
Interesting. Very good point. Very good point.
Where do we see that with the role of illegal immigration, and how are some of these, like, you know, what are the options for those people to get resources as well?
Terrific questions, Chris. Thank you very much. If you'll take the answers on the air, let me get some comments here. Who would like to start on this? Tony, do you want to start on this?
Just a very general comment. The taxation of, the
people
taxation
who are paying
question,
taxes.
Right. There are indirect taxes that everybody pays, not even if you don't file individually and pay directly. Mm-hmm. There's going to be indirect taxes that are paid. And the studies have shown that the net contribution to the tax system by undocumented people is very high.
Is very high?
Yes.
Really?
Right. So
what does that mean from their status? So just because they've been paying taxes isn't going to help them have a status, is it?
No, but it also, part of the proposed rules were that you had to pay taxes mm-hmm. before.
For a period of years.
For a period of years.
Yeah.
And that's also, it's almost pay to play. If you really want your status, you have to pay back taxes. That's one of the things that they're...
Anybody else on this one?
Well, Chuck...
Tom, go ahead.
In Indiana, they just recently released a study by the New American Economy, the contributions of new Americans in Indiana, and we have a significant immigrant population, but maybe not as big as some other states, and they basically, foreign nationals pay taxes, and they have a breakdown here. Asians in Indiana earned $3.3 billion and paid $996.5 million in taxes. Hispanics, $2.3 billion earned, $5.67 million in taxes paid. Middle Eastern and North African, $303 million in income and $89 million in taxes. And Sub-Saharan African, $276 million earnings and $70 million in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
There is an underground economy. Not everybody's getting taxes withheld from their earnings, but most of them are.
And okay, one other thing I wanted to point out about that is not only are most, or at least many, but most undocumented immigrants paying taxes, but a lot of them don't get the benefits in return. So, for example, there's plenty of undocumented immigrants who pay taxes through their paychecks, but earn so little that they don't need to file income tax returns, for example, and so don't bother, or they're afraid to file tax returns but are eligible for a refund and don't ever get their refund. And so I think it's important to understand that more often than not, they're paying, but they're not getting the benefits that people with status get.
But merely paying the taxes is not something that gets them over, let's say, the wall to be able to be here as a documented person. No, okay. No. What about Chris's other question, where, let's say, someone may have been arrested for some minor offense. Maybe that person might have been driving a vehicle unlicensed or something that was not a serious crime, and for some reason, and this is just an example, and for some reason was arrested and was put in jail but couldn't pay bail. And he's wondering, how would that affect someone who wants to become a documented resident of the United States? Any comments on this?
Well, it affects them in a couple of different ways. One is being incarcerated and not being able to pay bail leads them to the possibility of having immigration enforcement taken on their cases. And there's been development on this, and things have changed such that the holds that Immigration and Customs Enforcement were able to place on people now are not in place. But once that person gets released from custody after going through their process and they get back home, we're finding that they are subject to getting picked up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement's ICE officers, picked up from their homes, like right outside of, you know, their criminal process is over, they've done their time, or they've been convicted, or the charges have been dismissed, and then an ICE officer comes to their homes and picks them up, and then they're put into immigration detention, and then you have a whole other set of a bond that they can't pay.
So this is something that would follow someone.
Absolutely.
Even if the violation was a minor criminal violation.
Yeah, we see it all the time, you know? Yeah.
Well, Chris, there's your answer, really, and unfortunately, in terms of what can follow someone, even if it's a minor offense. We have remaining in the program probably 2 or 3 minutes. What have we not even touched upon, Tom Ruge, that you would like to present?
Well, I'm still stuck on the DACA decision by the Fifth Circuit and rankled by it somewhat. And there's a real fundamental question. This may want some people may have their own views on the policy question of whether a state should be involved at all in litigation like this. And my starting point is that state government should be for everybody, right? Should protect the rights and interests of everyone. So my idea of when they would be adversely affected by a federal decision or rulemaking should be pretty direct before they can go to court and say you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that they might have to issue some more driver licenses, and that gives them standing to challenge a federal law that they're not directly affected by, really, is, to me, a real stretch. But I wondered what other people thought about that.
Any comments in response to what Tom's concern is?
Yeah, this is Miriam. I get that question a lot, which is, how come Texas and 20, you know, five other states, how come they get to decide what happens all over the country? How come these programs can't go into effect in California, for example, where the climate here wouldn't allow that kind of action? So that's a question we ask ourselves a lot, and it hasn't really been resolved yet. How is it that this injunction is nationwide, even though it's only half of the states in the U.S. That were party to it? So it's something that's really interesting that we're just trying to, you know, we're hoping that there will be additional action, you know, as far as like prospective, maybe things that could happen in the future, is that maybe, you know, there's been talk among the litigation community, which, you know, we're direct services, so we don't know, you're not necessarily as tuned in as maybe as Tom would be. But, you know, we were hoping that maybe another action is going to be filed in a different circuit, which would then cause a split among the circuits, with the Fifth Circuit ruling one way and another circuit acting another way, which would then lead to going back to the Supreme Court and getting this issue actually heard and resolved once and for all.
Tommy, were you trying to say something?
That there were several states that filed briefs, and municipalities and individuals and experts have filed what they call amicus briefs, the friend of the court briefs, on the side of the government in opposition to the state of Texas and Alabama, the ones that got in. So it's far from a situation where all the states are against this, not at all, as Mary points out.
Well, the problem is, with the Supreme Court without nine members, we have real problems, not only in the immigration area, but many other areas, unfortunately. The court, I think most people would say, is crippled, and that is it's really tragic, and I certainly hope after the election in November we will see that we have restored nine Supreme Court justices on the court. Anybody else who has something that you'd like to present very, very briefly, if you would?
I guess I just want to reiterate, this is Miriam again, that DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which was announced in June of 2012 by President Obama, that program is still in effect. And that's actually a large segment of the clients that I work with. And we've gotten a lot of questions from the community as far as, you know, is this still in effect? The new stuff that was announced, that there was an injunction, has DACA in it. So does that mean that DACA from 2012 was affected? No, it was not affected. So if, you know, people who are eligible for that program to apply for the first time for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or maybe they're applying for renewal, though, you know, those are still avenues that are open to people.
Well, I want to thank you. We haven't been able to cover everything, but I think you've done a beautiful job of trying to educate people in this. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Elise Shugal, Directing Attorney, Immigration Program, Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto. Miriam Kelly, Senior Attorney and Supervisor of the DACA DAPA Program at Community Legal Services. Tom Ruge, thanks so much for joining us, Tom, from Indianapolis, Indiana.
My pleasure. I don't know how you found me out here.
Oh, hey, man, we've got people looking for you. Tom is a civil trial advocate, National Board of Trial Advocacy partner in the Indianapolis, Indiana law firm of Lewis Capps. And my friend, J. Antonio Nieres, certified specialist in immigration and nationality law, member of the board of directors of the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Thank you all. Very nice to have you on the program. Next time on Your Legal Rights, the topic is employment law, and we're going to be talking about shared, also known as gig economy, provided by Uber, Airbnb, Lyft, and other work opportunities. This is something that is obviously across the country. My guests will be employment law and real estate law attorneys Tad Devlin and Aaron Minnis. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on Your Legal Rights, and join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney.